All right, so hi everyone. I would first like to thank Lars Ulfsten for inviting me here to this workshop, otherwise I wouldn't be here to give you this talk, and also the organizers for organizing this beautiful conference. And so today I'll be talking about footprints of the Sagittarius Dwarf galaxy in the Milky Way, from the outer disk to the Gaia volume. This stems from work that I've been doing in the last 4 years or so, when I was at Columbia and switched from extragalactic to galactic astronomy. And actually, I've had some encounters with galactic astrophysics already during my undergrads at Cambridge, where basically one of the first plots that I've actually seen was this beautiful image of the field of streams by Vasily Belokurov in the early days of SDSS. And basically, this picture is showing us what the stellar halo looks like out there in our Milky Way, and is generally taken as a true testament for the hierarchical growth of galaxies like our Milky Way. And in fact, we've also seen stellar halos around other galaxies as well, from CD galaxies all the way to our closest neighbor, the Andromeda Galaxy. And this is also sort of a very beautiful map that's been produced by the PANDA survey over the years. And we can clearly see that there is a lot of action. There are even things that are pummeling through the disk. And so whenever we see this image, we generally see all these sort of non-quite phase-mixed structures in the stellar halo. And you know, we take this really as the evidence for accretion events, right? Satellite galaxies that came in and disrupted themselves, left all their trace of stars around the Milky Way. But do all the structures that we see in this map necessarily mean that they come from an accretion event? In particular, a structure that was found by Heidi Newberg in 2002, this monstrous ring here, you know, has been basically the subject of debate. You can clearly see that it's very close to the galactic midplane. And if you go and have a 3-pi view of this of the Milky Way towards the anticenter, in main sequence turnoff stars, you can see that effectively the galactic anticenter is pretty tumultuous. It has the monstrous ring again. It's been beautifully mapped by Colin Slater, and this is a map by Edouard Bernard. And then main sequence turnoff stars around, you know, 10 kiloparsecs away from us, structure, you know, above and below 30 degrees of latitude. But then this is not it. There are also other structures, right? We see this thing, the eastern banded structure, discovered by Carl Grillmeyer, and the anticenter stream, which is a very thin piece of stream that, you know, covers about 180 degrees on the sky in front of us. And all of these structures have been hypothesized to come from accretion events. So for Monstrous, for example, there's a model by Peña Rubio, 2005, you know, that basically a dwarf galaxy came in on a circular orbit, got disrupted, and left this material. And then we saw other structures, and we're like, okay, well, it probably came up with some very massive globular cluster, perhaps, or even a small dwarf companion, and these also left these structures. But the thing is, over the years, other overdensities have actually also been discovered, actually behind the monstrous, like, for example, the Trion clouds, which are over here. I mean, it's a bit difficult to see this in the PanSTAR image, but believe me, like, there is basically an overdensity of M giants that's been discovered right around, like, Andromeda. It's kind of like the orange color coding here, which is roughly at like 30 kiloparsecs away from us. But when you see this image, you also see that, well, there is actually something that's piercing through the disk. Okay, great. But then when we look in the solar neighborhood, we also see other like peculiarities. And you know, they were known already before Gaia, in the early days of, again, SDSS through Segway. And Larry Woodrow did this beautiful work showing basically residual over and under densities in the number counts as a function of galactic height, and then also a discovery of basically streaming motions, right? Sort of non-zero streaming motions about the vertical height. And similar results have been also derived by other survey teams like Rave Lemos, like it's Williams' 2013 paper as well. And, you know, the current picture that we see is now we're basically in the Gaia era. We're seeing this sort of beautiful phase-based spiral that was discovered by Teresa Antoja. And if you want to, you know, this is color-coded by V5, but if you want to actually just see it in the full classical sense, as which we know phase mixing, we can just go in over density, and this is shown here. And actually, this is just what we've actually always been seeing. It's always been there with us since SDSS. You can see this Morgan Bennett study, showing you basically these fluctuations in density, and you can see the wavelengths are exactly the same seen in the data. And effectively, this phase-space spiral has been always there, just that basically we've only seen the 1D projection. So the idea that I want to bring forward today is basically that maybe we can understand all of this by the impact of Sagittarius Aurora galaxy. And this is a beautiful study by Brani Cesar showing you the Aurelari in Sagittarius. And you can see that, you know, Sagittarius has been going around several times around the disk. It arrives at least twice. And it's the third most massive luminous satellite around the Milky Way. And its mass has been debated for quite a long time, actually. Already in the early days in the 2000s, James Binney was also proposing that maybe Sagittarius was more massive than 10 to the 9, perhaps 10 to the 11. This is an idea that got kind of dismissed, but it's kind of interesting to always like revisit problems with a new light. And this is what I want to present you today, which are basically these GAIA-DR2 models that I've developed. And what's new about these models is that what we've done is that we've tried to basically explain the outer disk and inner disk substructures by running full live and body models, where we assume sort of a galactic live and body model for the Milky Way, following sort of a mass model by Paul Macmillan and reasonable values for the kinematics, and basically follow the orbit of different progenitor satellites by varying the mass, but also the central density. Why? Well, we know from Lambda CDM that at least like the structure of dark matter halos follows a mass concentration relation, and for a given mass, you can have different central densities. And because Sagittarius has been stripped by 99% of its mass, obviously towards the end, it's really the central part of the galaxy that's going to matter and act on the galaxy. And so changing and varying your mass is one thing, but changing also the density can have also interesting degeneracies and implications. So this is what we did, and of course what we wanted to do was to cosmologically motivate this interaction. As Martin Weinberg talked a lot about, like his work from, you know, that was also, well, from like 1998, so that was like, you know, I was 10 years old back then. But already then he kind of recognized that actually when a subhalo falls, you know, into a larger galaxy, it basically there are like there's a resonant process that happens by which basically you can actually have the galaxy to sink through dynamical friction, and it creates the wake in the dark matter halo, which penetrates all the way deep down to the center of the galaxy. And so you do not need like a very massive perturber to actually tidally perturb your disk. You just need it to be somewhere at apocenter at 50 kpc, and it will already create sort of disturbances that get penetrate all the way at the center. And so this is kind of quantified here for like one of the models here. You can see that as a function of time, basically what's actually torquing the disk is really the halo in the early phases of Sagittarius info. And then towards the end, as Sagittarius gets closer to the disk, then it's really the tides that take over. And you can see this red spike. So what we saw is that indeed you can actually, for all of these different models, right, you know, vary the mass, like from 6 times 10 to the 10 all the way to 10 to the 11 solar masses, and then again different sort of concentrations. Basically, every model is able to reproduce the amplitude of the fluctuations that we see in the solar neighborhood. So that was actually kind of good. But then what happens actually to the disk as a whole? Well, you know, this is just taking one of the models, but generically there are basically vertical displacements that occur, and sort of as soon as you have like the first pericentric passage of Sagittarius, then you get basically this wake that penetrates all the way deep down towards the center of the galaxy. And so in the outer regions, what happens is that you actually warp the disk. And as subsequent passages come closer, these sort of vertical bending waves that you create basically amplify in amplitude and also increase in number. And what happens to the disk as a whole is that, well, you know, these waves propagate out and dissipate where they can basically thicken the disk. And so what you see is just a gradual flaring of the galactic disk. And actually, luckily, in the solar circle, things are good. Like, you're not actually messing the disk up. So you have a quite massive satellite, about a tenth or slightly less, or a 20th of the mass of the galaxy coming in, creating a lot of havoc but leaving your solar neighborhood quite intact, which is why basically all the different models are able to actually reproduce the amplitudes of fluctuations. But then you can then compare your various models to some of the observations of like various overdensities like A13 and Trion, which are sort of at sort of those heliocentric distances, and you can clearly see that, you know, for example, this model where Sagittarius was relatively low mass and low density is, well, does a pretty poor job at actually kicking disk material out to those latitudes, but then actually other models do fare quite well. In fact, this one even maybe too well, even too much effectively. But then, okay, this is all nice and good, this is just theory, but you know, it's always good to have a model, but then it's always good to go and test it in the observations, and that's what astronomy is about, right? Like, we always go and test things observationally. And the real tour de force is to, excuse me, effectively select some of these stars and measure their chemical abundances. And this is what, you know, we did with Maria Bergemann and Adrian Price-Whelan, Ralph Schoenrich also in the crowd, and Catherine Johnston, Tingley as well, I think. And so basically you can see this is like sodium against like Fe. And so these are the stars from Trion and A13 above and below the galactic midplane. And they all lie basically on top of sort of the thin disk stars. And you know, just for comparison, there are like some other satellites. And indeed, these abundances are actually consistent with them coming from the disk. So really, all the stuff that you're seeing is just disk material and nothing else. And actually, this result was pointed out early on, even like when I actually came to Columbia, when I met Adrian Price-Whelan when he was still a graduate student, where he did very beautiful work on looking at this ratio of R Lyrae to M Giants and showing that effectively the stellar populations in Trion are actually mostly consistent with them belonging to the galactic galactic disk. Okay, so that's all nice and cool. But you know, a model, you know, needs to, you know, also give you other predictions for it to be serious. And so, you know, basically you can also recreate the same structures that I've shown you that Carl Grillmeyer discovered, sort of like, you know, these like feathers. I mean, I call them feathers, but it's just nomenclature. And so you can see that, you know, in the simulation you also get sort of similar structures, similar like RMSs in the width. And what are these things? Well, effectively these are just tidal tails of the Milky Way that have been excited during the passage of Sagittarius and that basically subsist to the present day. And so what you can do is then you can select, So you can select, like an observer would, you know, these structures that you see in the sky, and then ask, where do they come from? And so you basically integrate the orbits of all these stars in this feather back in the early time, and you can see during the first pericentric passage, when Sagittarius excites sort of this wake, you know, basically what it does is that, so actually this is early times. Once you have the first pericentric passage, you excite this wake, and so you know there are resonances, so some parts of the disk get you know, flung away and set on new epicyclic orbits. So you know, this is a new, it goes on a new frequency, and then the subsequent passage basically amplifies the vertical excursion of this sort of tidal tail. And then again, you know, the guiding radius also varies as well as a function of time. And so then you can basically see the structure today. And interestingly, the values, because you know, you're in the outer disk, self-gravity is actually negligible for the disk stars. And so, cool enough, like basically all the frequencies actually lie on top of where you expect them for a full axisymmetric potential like we love them so much. And so you can potentially use these structures to just directly measure some of these like frequencies, right? Like if I fully like model this thing over the sky, and then basically take ratios, you know, between sort of, you know, basically follow this structure, you follow it in VZ, but then you also know that it's basically covering 180 degrees of the sky. If you offset the two, you take a ratio, you get basically nu. You can do the same to get kappa as well. So these are actually kind of useful to basically just get estimates for the second derivative of the potential. But great. But are these things also disk material? And the answer is yes, and we can do this. This is like work that I've been doing with Vasily, Sergey, Adrian, and Catherine. So here basically what I'm showing you is like stars selected in ACS and stars selected in Monoceros. And then you can ask, okay, does Apogee give me abundances? And the answer is yes, because it's such a cool public survey. And so you can see that, you know, again, these stars are well consistent with them coming from the thin disk. And actually, like, you know, preliminary result, actually it's also confirmed by Segway, but basically there is a smaller spread of metallicities for the ACS than there is for Monoceros. And this makes sense. ACS was excited long ago when the disk was just still forming, not very well, you know, not super chemically enriched. You lift this stuff, it gets completely decoupled, and it just continues and gets lifted up, which is why you see it above Monoceros. But then Monoceros, you know, all the material there comes from basically like subsequent like bending waves that, you know, basically propagated out and then thickened the disk. So then here you would basically expect to find like a larger diversity of stars in terms of metallicities. So okay, this is kind of cool. And now I would like to discuss, how long do I have left? 15 minutes? 10 minutes. No, we started at 45. I have 15 minutes. So basically Gaia-DR2 now has shown us a very beautiful like complex velocity field showing like radial signs of basically spiral arms in the mean radial velocity field, signs of kinematic warping in the vertical one, and then again like sort of again like these ridges from spirals. But then also we've discussed, and a lot of people will discuss in the future days, about basically this phase-based spiral, which Teresa Antoja used a toy model for phase mixing and derived basically a phase mixing timescale of, you know, 300 to 900 mega year, which is very close to the orbital timescale of Sagittarius. Well, at least like this part is 0.8 to 1.2. And so, yeah, so some people were a little bit upset to see number counts. And so I just made a plot for everybody to be happy that, yes, the phase-based spiral is there in the number counts as well. And the reason you don't see it is because you have to subtract the background. And so the question now to ask is, okay, can I find in my simulations a realization where I can reproduce the velocity field that we see from Gaia? Because, you know, the orbital timescale for Sagittarius is like 0.8 gigayears. So let's follow this up, you know, towards the end state of the simulation. And so Sagittarius basically comes for its last pericentric passage over here, where I've centered it, and basically follow the evolution of the velocity field. And indeed, you can find actually a snapshot where you can find actually almost, well, remarkable agreement, because these are pre-Gaia DR2 model. I didn't try to like plug in numbers or fudge anything. This is just what comes out from the model. You throw in Sagittarius from the viral radius all the way to the present day. This is what you get. In fact, you even get like basically this bridge here, which is due to the fact that you have basically like a changing density here. So, you know, for example, Sarah Pearson and Christina Eilers have been like working on trying to use the velocity field to say something about the density field. I think there's probably potential for that. And then you can, for that same snapshot, ask yourself, if I put myself in the solar neighborhood, what does it look like? And so indeed, you do find also kind of a remarkable phase-based spiral with like two wraps kind of thing, which is interesting. And so then you want to ask, okay, so why is this so? So during the last pericentric passage of Sagittarius, you basically excite sort of, you know, new generations of like bending waves that basically Larry Woodrow will probably talk a lot more about in the next couple of days. And what happens is that when you look in the solar neighborhood, so Sagittarius is at the other end of the disk, hits the disk, tidally perturbs it, and what you need to do is you have to wait half a galactic rotation, so about 100 mega years, to basically see it on the other side. Right here, I'm basically putting myself around the sun and looking at how the phase-based spiral evolves. And what we've actually shown in our paper already submitted in August 2018 was that basically the last pericentric passage actually resets, you see, erases all the coherent structure and resets the phase-based spiral. And then, you know, as you wait further in time, then you basically get like this tighter and tighter winding. And we can find like a time scale of about 0.8 gigayears, which is a little bit different to what James derived, but this might be actually due to the fact that, you know, this has self-gravity, and self-gravity seems to be important, at least from, you know, basically what Christophe was talking about, that something that Martin has been talking a lot about for several years, and also Keir Darling has also a beautiful paper on this, so I urge you to look at that. Okay, great. But then the last pericentric passage excites this phase-space spiral, but then it should have a particular shape, because if the impact was very recent, then I would expect that in the outer disk, where the orbital timescales are much shorter, to have basically a less wound spiral. And towards the inner region, well, because the restoring force is much stronger, the dynamical timescales are much shorter, I would expect something to be more squishy. And this is what happens when I go and look in DR2, just the RVS sample. This is like the beauty of the DPAC work right there. You get basically, more squishy, phase-space power, basically Antojas thing, and then basically 10 kiloparsec, less wound, more wider because of the lower self-restoring force. And this is basically showing you over two scale lengths. So that's pretty cool. But there should be other predictions that we can test in the outer disk. And this is where I want to take you. I want to take you to the outer disk, back to the outer disk, back where we started. And actually, the thing is, for example, with the red clump, future surveys like, STSS-5, actually Weave as well. I'm sorry I missed, but I don't have any preference for any surveys. I'm not part of any of you, your political stuff. But like, Weave as well is going to probably like measure this. And this is the type of thing you could see, because the orbital timescales are so much longer in the outer disk that you can effectively probe recent perturbations, which is from the last impact, but then also perturbations that were set like longer ago. This makes sense, right? What I've discussed with you about the ACS, right? It was much longer ago, so maybe we might be able to like pin down this picture further. There's been also a lot of like talking about basically the other models that could explain the phase-space spiral. But what I wanted to show you today is that the model that I'm proposing is able to get the outer disk structure, the mean velocity field that we see today in this, around us by the Gaia, from the Gaia volume, as well as the phase-space spiral, all of this simultaneously. So how do we test this? How can we say this is recent? You look at ages. You look at ages because Jason Saunders and Payal Das did a really good job. They gave me a compilation that I can find on the archive, and this is what I do. So I just basically look at different isochrome bins in age, and then I can see that basically the phase-space spiral has the same shape up to here. I mean, eventually it gets really noisy, but basically has the same shape at all stellar ages. They're isochrone ages. They're not absolute ages. They're relative ages. But one can be surely assured that between 6 and 9 and 1 to 3, or the youngest age bins, they're all the same. So that means that the perturbation must have been really recent. And sort of, from this, I take that it actually rules out a bar echo model. You can also use stellar dynamics, like James Binney and actually Teresa, as first pointed out. You can basically time, what is the timing of this? What I want to point out to you is that when you look actually a little bit more carefully to the data, you see extra wraps. So I'm wondering, if this doesn't mean that, maybe the time scale would be a little bit increased, right? You can see, 1, 2, 3, maybe four wraps. And so this is basically this wrap here, basically corresponds to this extra ridge out there. So I'm not going to talk too much about that, but there's beautiful things that you can do with the phase-space spiral, and Joss will talk a little bit more about this tomorrow. And there are also other curiosities that we can find in the Gaia data. Ivan Minchev already proposed back in 2009 that the galaxy is probably reacting to a massive merger a long time ago, and he basically predicted that all the ridges that we see here can be basically predicted from this one massive merger, these like arches in the UV plane, which actually appear also kind of subsequently equally spaced. And the prediction was that below Arcturus, which is this thing here, you should get like two more ridges. And we do find them. And I've given them the name of Snoop and Herbie. If you don't know who they are, you can Google them. But they're basically great artists. Like, this is probably 5 decades of like music innovation. And this guy is also very innovative. He has a recent gospel album even. So go and check that out. But then we also see ridges in the VZ direction, which was has not been shown before. Like, people have focused a lot about these sort of ridges and, well, also like these ones, but Daisuke was looking at. But yeah, we can find basically new ridges, and then we can also see that some of them have basically coherent vertical motions. And then we can also see these undulations, and, you know, basically the whole game is try to figure out, okay, could Sagittarius, could Sagittarius like excite this, or could it be the bar? Or could it be simultaneously many things together, right? The spirals and all that. And actually, like, so Wilmer gave a very beautiful talk, and I think we'll hear a bit more about this as well from Jason tomorrow. But like, you know, just a heads up, you know, the simulation also kind of reproduces some ridges as well. So, you know, and here, of course, there's many less ridges because, you know, I don't resolve the phase space as well. Okay, these were run even before Gaia, so like, you know, you're gonna have to wait basically perhaps like a couple of months before I show you what it looks like. And so I will just go down to my conclusions and probably play this little movie. Okay, there we go. And so what I hope to convey to you is basically the Sagittarius dwarf is likely responsible for the many of the asymmetries that we see in the from the outer disk all the way to the inner region. I've presented you detailed live in-body models that actually take into account a lot of the ingredients that we have from cosmological simulations, which we'll hear more about tomorrow, and basically showing that Sagittarius can both account for the local perturbations that we see, but also the global ones. And, you know, in order to discriminate models, one really should not just focus on your favorite or pet observation, like this, for example. This is great. But one should really look at all the data that Gaia is giving us, because this is the only way we can basically pin down what's going on with our Milky Way. I've presented you some reinterpretation of some of the thin streams that we see in the Andes Center. They're not globular clusters. They're not to swarm the dwarf galaxies. They're really disk material, and think that we understand how these actually form. Basically, the phase space spiral, I hope that I convinced you, is just basically the 2D manifestation of these like vertical oscillations that we actually knew about back in the Segway days. Basically, something like this phase space spiral is likely to have been basically set, you know, between 500 to probably 800 mega years, and this is something that probably needs to be studied a little bit more, because now we have like these like more intricate maps than just looking at the V-Phi plane, which I think is actually a little bit limiting. I hope that I convinced you that basically the outer disk holds signs of earlier perturbations. The bar buckling echo model is actually ruled out by the data, simply because of the phase-space spiral amplitude that we see in the data and in the models, but also basically the shape of the phase-space spiral as a function of radius, and as well as in the ages. So I think we can basically already use the GaiaDR2 data to actually just rule this out. And then phase space has like two extra wraps, and, you know, basically in the Sagittarius in a model where, you know, the galaxy was affected by a merger, we should expect extra ridges below Arcturus, and we found them, and I will take your questions, and I think, yeah.
From one simulation. Wow.
Yeah, pre-Gaia DR2. Not even, I didn't even bother about Gaia.
Two quick questions. First, what about the LMC and the SMC? Second, can you really constrain like how massive does the Sag halo have to be at infall to do all this stuff?
Okay, so first question, which was what about the LMC and the SMC? So, well, the LMC actually, in the paper that we wrote, like the original paper where we presented the simulations, I've presented also runs where I have actually the LMC and Sagittarius pummeling the disk together. What happens with the LMC is that it's, you know, coming in for the first time. At least that's what we think from the proper motions, from several different arguments, timing arguments from Jorge Peña Rubio, etc. And so, in the first infall model, what happens is that the LMC basically just through basically the wake of the dark matter halo that it excites, basically like warps the disk, actually even reproduces the lines of node that we see in the H1 data. And so this is basically a model like for just the LMC on its own. But when you add the LMC to Sagittarius, I don't have the plot here, but I can show it to you later, what happens is that it just basically modulates the signal from Sagittarius a little bit. But it doesn't actually sort of, It just modulates the outer disk, but it doesn't really do anything to the inner disk. And in fact, if you're going to ask, like, what happens with, you know, just the LMC, you know, pumping the disk, you can see that basically in the solar neighborhood, the disk is not even reacting. It's not. It doesn't even. It's not even aware that the LMC is coming in. Second question, Sagittarius, like about the mass of Sagittarius. Well, I think it's a question about basically what is the halo property. Probably its density, but like in terms of mass, so the models that basically fared the best with sort of the velocity field of the Milky Way in the Gaia DR2 thing. That was basically the L2 model, which is basically a Sagittarius model with 6 times 10 to the 10 solar masses and a concentration of 20 or something. So effectively, the other models that I checked, you know, basically went over the roof, and so we're already ruled out. So at least we know that like 10 to the 11 is actually already ruled out. It's basically discussed in the paper. But now, yeah, now the thing is, we have all this beautiful data. We can start playing. If somebody wants to really fit that thing properly. I think like we went quite far already, but there's still food for thought.
So a couple of quick questions. How did your orbits that you showed seem pretty similar to what we had in Purcell et al. 2011, which were, you know, mainly ad hoc orbits. So I'm wondering how you derived those orbits. Are they observationally motivated in some way aside from, you know, trying to match the stream and other features?
So. Yep. This is actually discussed at length in the paper. Our starting point was the beautiful work by Chris Purcell. I've used these initial conditions myself too, you know, with the work with Adrian, actually Facundo as well. And so, you know, already back then, what you did was actually working fairly well in getting sort of the rough stream properties, you know, basically like position on the sky, and radial velocities for the M giants from Steve Majewski. So we took basically that and we just integrated backwards and, you know, find similar structures. So effectively, this, you know, we don't want to fit, right? Because we're assuming a spherical model, live in-body model. You can't fit. But what you can get is a very reasonable orbit for Sagittarius, and this is what we do. And indeed, it seems like it's working, right? Like, we are able to reproduce the stream on the sky and the radial velocities to a reasonable extent.
Okay, so maybe I'll just make a comment instead of asking my second question. If you try to get observationally motivated orbits instead of the ad hoc orbits that we used in Purcell et al. For example, from using the HST proper motions and integrating backwards, it doesn't match the older work in Purcell et al. 2011. It's just something to be aware of.
Sure, but you know, it's only a small variation. I think like what really matters is really the impact that it happens. So, you know, for example, you know, Sagittarius does not end up in the right position, you know, exactly in the right position, and that I discussed this at length in the paper. But what really matters is basically the salient features that come up from this model. So I agree with you. It's great if somebody wants to fit this thing, and good luck. But the thing is, you know, I'm not interested in fitting. I'm interested to understand like what is the global properties and what can Sagittarius do. And this is what this work was really based about.
Okay, Joss.
So that was a great presentation. I was doing a mental note of all the slides I had to remove, which is like half my talk. So I thought at least I'd have my movies to show, right? Slides through Gaia, Spiral, in abundance. Unfortunately, you've already shown one. So
no, but you will show the one with the V5 stuff.
I have a few scatterings left, yeah. But one thing we did obsess over, and I know you thought about it a lot in the context of all the things you were looking at in terms of structures, was the true nature of Sag's orbit, which included the stripping from, going to James's question, falling in at some very high mass, then stripped down to something much, much less, and the number of crossings. And we had to worry about also the gas phase, because that also matters in terms of the number of local crossings because of the impact on
this. Yes, there's a taper.
So I think we got to 3 or 4 crossings in 2 billion years. Others say it's more like 7. And the last orbit coming in, which is really troublesome, comes in, it's in the same plane, but it's coming in at quite an acute angle. Mm-hmm. And that acute angle also has this effect of forward-backward propagation into the disk itself. So my question to you is, how many crossings do you have Which are you in a low number of crossings, a very high number of crossings?
Well, so this is shown, I mean, I already showed this in the plot, but like, you know, we can discuss this if you want further.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, there is 5 pericentric passages. I can show you also the orbits, like.
So five. That's
five pericentric.
Yeah, that's in the range. Yeah.
Yeah,
so we found if we just had the last orbit coming through on an angle, and did not include the previous crossings, you did not get the same result. So, because for example, the previous ones mess up the disk so much, the spiral becomes more fuzzy for us. So we just washes it away.
Well, also I think like you know something. You're probably looking at this, right? But like, you know, you also kind of ran out of particles, right? I think you had like 1 million particles, and you know, already here we had 5 million, and
agreed. You have
I mean, we have larger amounts, but it was also difficult to sort of see this structure. So, you know, I wouldn't jump to conclusions too quickly. I think you're probably also running like very high resolution simulations right now.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to, you know, be more firm on this.
I think my only comment is I think we're going to have to worry about the details of the orbit in the future.
One step at a time, right?
Like, yeah.
I agree.
Larry, I think was next. Larry.
It wasn't clear. Did your disk form a bar? It looked like there was spiral structure toward the center, but it wasn't obvious it was a bar, and should that be a constraint on the underlying disk model?
Yeah, actually, well, there is a bar forming. Okay, here. Right. And actually, yeah, like sort of, you know, basically when we did these maps, like the bar is actually, you know, positioned at the same angle that we see. And actually, I think there are some interesting peculiarities. So, for example, I don't know if Ismail, are you showing your poster? No. Okay. Well, we'll just flash you his result. So Ismail basically has been working a little bit with me and Marie Martigues and Ivan Minchev and Matthias Steinmetz. And so you know he used basically the star horse code to sort of derive new distances for the Gaia volume, and then basically made this map, which is data. And then try to compare it basically between two models. One basically where the disk is sort of securely evolving with a bar that's formed in a cosmological context, but where there's not much activity. And so he finds sort of a velocity pattern that's not exactly the bar is always like aligned the same way. Doesn't find any similarities. And basically this structure actually seems to be the same as a function of time, no matter how you move it. Whereas this impact model, you know, basically it's quite dynamic, but it does actually sort of reproduce nicely some of the. So I don't know, maybe this is perhaps a hint, but I think you know, like for example, Sarah Pearson is also looking at these models a little bit more in more detail, and I think you know she probably had a wrap-up slide. So for people who want to just check it out, like go and check it out. But yeah, it might be possible to actually use this velocity. Data to actually further also constrain like certain things about the bar model, especially with what Ortwin's been talking about this morning. Yeah, so I think that would be good for discussion altogether.
Okay, Justin is next.
Hi, great talk. Yeah, there's been a lot of interest in these ultra diffuse galaxies, especially the ones that allegedly lacking dark matter. And I've always thought of Sagittarius as an archetype for this actually, because if it fell in at 6 × 10^10, it would have had a velocity dispersion of about 25, 30 kilometers per second. But we know if we measure it today, it's got a velocity dispersion of about 18. 10 kilometers per second. What? So I don't know if you've looked.
18, I don't know, I know 18. From wow. Fincher Boy? Like.
17?
Well, 20. 10, where do you measure it?
10, 10 is the old Ibata number.
No. Fincher Boy 2012 is 18.
Anyway,
but there's a large uncertainty, so it could be higher or it could be lower, right?
The point is, have you looked at this in your simulation? Because you can plot the evolution of the Sagittarius and see basically how its apparent mass to light ratio changes.
Yeah, so I did look a little bit at that. Gibbons has also looked at that. They also ran basically quite massive models as well, and actually I find similar results to them. Basically, like in all the realizations that I presented you today, like the central velocity dispersion is either at like 18 or lower kilometers a second. So yeah.
Thank you. From Robin.
At the risk of beating a quickly dying horse, So about this business of the orbit of Sagittarius, do you have an intuition about which things are the most important to get right in the orbit in order to do what you're trying to do? Like, I mean, obviously, Sorter, you have to.
I'm not trying to.
You have to get the paracenter
right now,
pretty close.
I feel like
probably,
working on something else
stuff.
Too now, but.
But like, it's probably worth thinking about, like, which things are really the most important to, like, understand better. Because, like, if really all you care about is thumping the disk with the right frequency and the right, like, location in physical space and right velocity vector or whatever, then you don't need to get the whole orbit right other than, you know, bringing it in cosmologically. I think that makes a lot of sense.
No.
But you don't have to worry about the fact that, like, you know, obviously you can't match every part of the stream with, if you use a spherical model for the halo and so forth, but it may not matter so much for this sort of seismic.
Yeah, so I agree. It's what matters is the question you're asking. So, you know, in the early days when, for example, like, you know, Facundo was looking at this with Larry's result, right? He was basically using the models from Chris Purcell, and he was only interested in what happens in the solar neighborhood. But if you started asking about this model, what happens in the outer disk, like, you're not even able to kick stuff out, like, above, like, you know, 10, 15 degrees. So, you know, at the time, I think, like, you know, people had mixed feelings about this model. And so, you know, so what do you need to get right? Well, it depends, like, what you're asking, right? So if you're, say, only focused on what happens in the solar neighborhood, I agree with you that, at least from what I've shown here, in the last pericentric passage, Sagittarius seems to wipe out all coherent structures and then resets the space-based spiral. I think that's a fair assumption to basically, you know, play around with toy-ish models, like, you know, for example, like what Teresa, what James done. One can do that, right? And one can, you know, do it perhaps with, you know, changing various assumptions about, like, what was the central density of the galaxy and what was the bound mass. But, you know, that's only as far as you can get, I think. For example, if you use, what I would like to argue is if you use the whole disk and you use also the structures, like, for example, something like the ACS, and that you might be able to peer into, like, prior perturbations, then that will say something about what was the mass and what was the structure of Sagittarius at different times. And if you can use that as a constraint to constrain the orbital history of Sagittarius, I think that would be great, in line with what people have done, you know, over the years with stream fitting, right? Like, we can't just, like, say, okay, well, I'm just going to use the disk now. You have to do, you know, both, for example. So if we want to reconstruct the orbital mass history of the galaxy, I think we need basically both approaches, like both the stream fitting and also, like, but I can't give you, like, a definite answer, right? It really depends on what is the problem that you're interested in.
So Kanya wants to come back.
So maybe I can just contrast the situation with the LMC, right? So Grutina Besla and others have done a lot of work where they've taken the HST proper motions, integrated backwards mm-hmm. to get the orbit, right? Yeah. And integrated forwards to look at the effect. So that's what I was asking when I was asking about orbits earlier, right? Now, it turns out that for Sag, you can't quite do that. And
no,
you
know, it's hard.
Right? So if you, and I'm not talking about fitting to streams, right? So if you take the HST proper motions for Sag and integrate backwards, you don't recover the Purcell et al. Orbit.
Yeah, of course.
So
not.
You don't
model dynamical friction, right?
No, but you can include it's trivial.
But you can
include
it, but it's a prescription. It's a toy model for dynamical friction. It's the Chandrasekhar 1943.
Well, you know,
formula.
Nevertheless, it's trivial to include dynamical friction and do that. So it's, I just, you know, I think it's kind of an interesting difference between these cases. And one question that I still have in my mind, of course, you're presenting a lovely model here and you're able to recover mm-hmm. a number of features, is, you know, can we derive a more observationally motivated orbit for Sag that also works?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one could potentially do that, but one has to make a lot more assumptions. The thing with the LMC is that things are easy. So on a first info, you know, I can, you know, I presented even the first, like, live n-body models of, like, the LMC hitting the Milky Way, you know, and creating this wake and the warp. And it's easy to fit this, right, because you just have a very short time scale. The problem with Sagittarius is that you have, like, all these passages, so you have to include the tidal stripping, You have to include the dynamic friction because you don't know what mass it started with. This is a much harder problem. I mean, if somebody wants to tackle this, great. Spend your 20 years of your life and do this. But like, I'm not going to do this. Rodrigo, when I started, Rodrigo told me, like, you're going to like break your teeth with this thing. And yeah, like, we did, right? It was hard. And I don't want to do it. But like, if you want to do it, great.
OK, we have one last question.
OK, this is a very comprehensive talk. I want to ask you about your opinion on the formation of the ridge lines in the RV5 diagram. And also from your model, do we have any time constraints on the formation of this kind of ridge lines?
As you saw, like the as you saw the model, as you saw the model doesn't have that many ridges. Well, first of all, it doesn't have that many ridges, but it doesn't even populate the phase space where you would actually expect other ridges. So right now, I can't really give you an answer. I think it's, you know, like Shurya Khanna, Khanna. But isn't it KH?
Sorry.
I thought KH is pronounced Kha, but so Shurya, for example, like looked a little bit at this, and I think probably Just will probably mention one or two things tomorrow. So the thing is, I think none of us, like Jason, me, like Shurya, like, you know, we probably get like four ridges at most, but not more. And I think this is probably because we just do not have enough phase space resolution to, you know, go down to the very low low velocities. And so I don't know. I haven't really thought about. But for example, what Robin was saying, right? If you do the experiment where you just want to wonder like what happens with the last pericentric passage of Sagittarius and what it excites both in the UV plane, the V5 R plane, and the phase space spiral, then one can actually do these type of models where, you know, you would be probably influenced by what James did with Ralph and run the full n-body model, given a set of reasonable assumptions, you know, not just a point mass hitting the disk, but you know, actually like, you know, having a reasonable mass profile, and then check, you know, see what happens. I think that's it's a bit brute force and perhaps not super interesting for some. I mean, I don't think I want to do this, but you know, it's something to be investigated, definitely.
Okay, well, Vasily says he has a short question. I hope he gets a short answer.
I want to answer Justin. That within the inner parts of Sagittarius, there's 10 to the 9 solar masses worth of mass, according to Steve's modeling of his own data. So it's not really dark matter 3 galaxy.
I wasn't trying to claim that it's that. I was simply claiming that the velocity dispersion
one. You're right, Vasily. I did not mean to imply that Sagittarius is dark matter 3. I don't think that anyone would suggest that. I merely meant that its stellar dispersion is much lower than it would have been before it fell into the Milky Way.
A little bit.
Yours goes down by a factor of 2 or 3 almost.
All right. Okay, I think we are ready for that. Thank Kevin again.
Okay, thank you.